The contents of this 13th chapter are simply a record of David beginning to reap the harvest of his sin. We left our study last time as David reached something of a new high point in his life with the conquest of Rabbah. Having plunged into the depths of sin and wickedness with Bathsheba, going through the dark valley of sorrowful repentance, restored by God's grace to standing in fellowship before God again, one of the indicators of that restoration was the victory that God had given him at Rabbah. And it must have been a time of euphoria, a time of joy, a time of celebration in David's life and heart, made all the more so, no doubt, by his recognition that he deserved no such favor from the hand of God. Conscious of the awfulness of his fall, the wickedness of his sin, it would have been all the more sweet and blessed and glorious that the Lord in mercy had given David victory once more over his enemies. But the joy of conquest and victory was soon to be tempered with the bitter reality that sin has consequences. It came to pass after this. Those are always interesting, solemn words in Scripture, providing a connection between events that the Lord particularly wants us to see. It came to pass after this. There was the joy. There was the victory. There was the celebration. There was the blessing of God. And yet even in that, events were soon to demonstrate to David that sin has a very bitter and sorrowful harvest. His own family was suddenly turned into a battleground as the forces of sin and depravity and the wickedness of the human heart were unleashed in devastating power within the confines of David's own home. Perhaps for the moment in Rabbah, David may have been tempted to think that he had emerged from his fall with Bathsheba with relative impunity. He had, as we have seen, been greatly humbled as the Spirit of God broke his heart, as he endured the agonies of conviction and was plunged into the depths of despair over his own vileness and his own sin, finding pardon and grace, of course, with the Lord. But perhaps at that moment of celebration in Rabbah, David might have been tempted. I suggest that because we are so ready to believe that we can sin with impunity. Maybe David thought when the battle was going well and he had just set the crown of the king of the Ammonites upon his head, maybe it crossed his mind then, you know, I have come out of this all right. The consequences to sin are not quite what I thought them to be. Our hearts are ready to believe that lie because that's why we go back to the same old sins. That's why we go back to do what we vowed before God time and time again we'd never go back to. Because the old man is ready to believe the lie, I can do this and get away with it. And maybe for a time in David's heart there was the thought, you know, this is not as bad as what I expected. No doubt as he was under the convicting power of God, as the Spirit strove with him and broke him and humbled him, he may have anticipated some dreadful chastening from the Lord. And it may just well have been now that he thought, well, this is not too bad at all. But after this, the fruits of his sin began to appear. In spite of the euphoria and the celebration of victory, there was a heavy shadow that hung over David's life. It was a shadow caused by the words of the Lord in the verse 10 of chapter 12. Now therefore, the sword shall never depart from thine house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. That was the word of God, and that word must stand. The somber truth now begins to dawn upon David's heart as never before, that there is a harvest to be reaped from sin. And as we read this chapter and look at it this evening with the Lord's help, that would be the lesson that I would want to learn, and I would want to impress upon your heart as well, that there are consequences to sin. There are tragic, awful, far-reaching, heartbreaking consequences to sin. We cannot sin with impunity. David found it to be so. From this point on, to the end of his life, to a greater or lesser degree, at every turn, David was reaping the harvest of his sin with Bathsheba. Every significant event in his life from this point now until his death is heavy with the consequences of his awful sin in adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. It is in that event that there is a turning point in David's life. Yes, he was restored. Yes, God blessed him to a degree. Yes, the Lord used him to a degree after that. But life was never the same because of the consequences of sin. I'm going to point out, first of all, the very simple lesson that there are consequences to sin. This is what David learns. This is what we learn as we look at the record of this 13th chapter. There are consequences to sin. Now, God has decreed that the law of harvest applies to the matter of sin. In Galatians chapter 6, in the words of the verse 7, be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. We're not to be deceived about this. It seems such a simple thing. But Paul, in stating this truth, prefaces it with this warning: do not be deceived. Why does he write that? He writes it because there is a danger that we will be deceived, because it is in our heart to deceive us about this matter. Our heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Our heart deceives us so easily on this point that somehow we think that we can defy the laws of nature and sow to the flesh and not reap a harvest of sin. But Paul warns, don't be deceived. Don't be taken in. There are consequences to sin. Such a basic point, but he makes it here and emphasizes it by the warning about the danger of being deceived. God is not mocked. To believe anything else about sin than what is stated here is to mock God. To believe that we can sin and sin and sin and nothing ever come of it. To believe that even a single sin can be engaged in without consequence is to mock God. Literally, the word is to turn up our nose at God. It is to defy Him. It is to despise Him. It is to detest Him. It is to mock Him. To think, it doesn't matter if I sin. It doesn't matter if I disobey any of the commands of God. It doesn't matter if I obey or disobey this command or that. It doesn't really matter. It's not of any significance whether I take the Word of God seriously and the commands of God seriously. It doesn't really matter. Hasn't God saved me? Hasn't He redeemed me? Aren't I sure of heaven? It doesn't matter how I live. That's how many professing Christians live. But God has decreed that there is consequence to sin, that it does matter how we live. And to hold any other view of sin than that which is stated here is to defy God and to mock at Him. But be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that and that only shall he also reap. The law of harvest applies. God has decreed it. If there's sowing, there will be reaping. If there's a sowing to the flesh, then there will be of the flesh a reaping, the corruption, the destroying, ruining effects of sin. That's what God has decreed. And so long as God is what He is, the law of that law of harvest will apply to the matter of sin. There are consequences to sin. We must remember that. Every sin, whether we dismiss it as little or large, there are consequences. And that consequence is always corruption, a ruining, destroying, spoiling effect. Now the harvest of sin, as we look at it, particularly demonstrated in David's life here, the harvest of sin is the product of God at work in justice. It is the product of God working providentially in the circumstances of the life in divine justice. When you read the gruesome record of chapter 13, with the vile crimes that are recorded there, with the heart-sickening record that is penned here in Holy Writ, when you read that, it is a solemn thing to realize that there you have a record of God seeing to it that David reaped exactly what he sowed. And God is not the author of sin. But this is the record of God in sovereign justice seeing to it that men reap what they sow. Go back to chapter 12 and the verse 11. Part of Nathan's message to David that broke his heart. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. And I will take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. Now every man is responsible for his own sin, but God, as the sovereign judge of all the earth, in justice sees to it that men reap exactly what they sow. These events in 2 Samuel 13, we have a solemn record of God in justice as the God of harvest, dictating, seeing to it sovereignly, as He disposes the affairs of men, seeing to it that David reaped exactly what he had sown. We looked this morning as we were thinking of the second commandment in the Sunday school class. In Exodus chapter 20, the words are familiar to you, where the Lord, speaking of punishing idolaters, speaks of punishing the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Each generation in their turn rose up to hate God and bore the guilt of their own sin. But God, in His sovereign disposition of the affairs of men, saw to it that men reap what they sow generation after generation after generation. Here is a solemn thing. You reap what you sow, and you reap what you sow because God will see to it that you reap what you sow. God Almighty in justice will see to it that the sinner reaps what he sows, that the backslider reaps what he sows, that every offense which is a sowing to the flesh, God has said, and He will see to it that there is a reaping of corruption. Now, in working out that justice, to bring home to the offender the fruits of his sin, God employs natural means. We've been thinking of the law of harvest. And if you think of the planting of a seed and that seed germinating and growing and then a harvest being reaped from it, you have an illustration of the point. In a sense, you can observe in every seed the working of God. He is at work to give life, to produce a harvest from that seed. If God doesn't work, it'll not grow. But nevertheless, in the natural law of creation, God has said you plant a seed and it grows. There is, at one level, the evidence of God at work. On another level, it's just the natural law that is written into the universe. And when you look at David's life here, there wasn't some supernatural bolt of lightning that made a sudden supernatural intervention into his life. There was rather the natural use of natural means. It's like the planting of a seed, and sooner or later there is a harvest from that. Oh yes, God is at work to see to it that sin comes home to roost. But nevertheless, there is here, very simply, the natural means of children being influenced by the example of their father, growing up to live as he has taught them by example, entering into his sin and reaping the consequences, or him reaping the consequences of his sin in them. It was as if David had taken the seed of his sin and planted it in Amnon's life and heart, and planted it in Absalom's heart and life. And yes, God was at work to see to it that justice was done, that the harvest was reaped, but that natural law was at work as well. What you plant, you reap. And David, by his own example, the example of a father, the example as a king, had planted seeds in the lives of his children that bore such a dreadful harvest. There are consequences to sin. The Lord will see to it. Let's move on to see something else here, that the harvest of sin is often reaped in the sin and suffering of children. The sins and the suffering of David's children were the harvest of his own sin. The harvest of David's sin is unquestionably seen in his family here. Particularly, you have two offenders brought to our notice. You have Amnon dealt with first of all in the chapter, and then Absalom, David's two sons. And the harvest of David's sin is seen. The seeds that David had sown in his own sin now begin to sprout and to grow in the lives of his children. Let's think of Amnon first of all. I don't want to take the time to go into all the details of Amnon's sin here. The record, I think, stands plain and clear. But as we think of it, Amnon's crime against Tamar exhibits remarkable similarities to David's own sin. There are a number of parallels that we can trace. Because just as you reap exactly what you sow, so there is now a reaping of exactly the same kind of sin in Amnon's life. How did it begin? Look at verse 1. It came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. His was an unlawful love, inspired by a sinful response to natural beauty. Is that not exactly what David found? As back in chapter 11, in the verse 2, he looks upon Bathsheba. He saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon, and David sent and inquired after her. There was an unlawful, an illegitimate response to natural beauty. Bathsheba, a beautiful woman by all accounts. Tamar, we're told, was fair, physically beautiful and attractive. And Amnon's crime against her began exactly as David's sin had begun, with that unlawful response to that natural beauty. Just as David had broken down the barriers that were raised in his path to keep him from sin, so Amnon does the same here. It's very interesting just to see in the language of chapter 13 the various barriers and checks to his sin that had been raised, and that he just breaks down in willful, stubborn defiance of God and presses on in his sin just as David had done. We're told that he was vexed in verse 2 because he thought it hard for him to do anything to her. He knew it was wrong. He knew it was wrong. And he chafed under that vexation in his evil lust. He pined. It wore him down. He made himself sick as he chafed under the restraint of conscience upon his sin. Verse 12, you have Tamar's pathetic words, but nonetheless reminding him of the law of God, of the Judah that God required of him, the folly that it would be to defy God, the shameful consequences in her own life if he pursued the course that he was set upon. But all that was meaningless to Amnon in the headstrong nature of his lust at this time. It's also noteworthy, just if you read down through the verses, to note the reference to my sister, my sister, my sister, even as he speaks of her. These are terms that should have put an end to his awful wickedness. She speaks to him as my brother. These are terms, I say, that should have stopped him. But he presses on in the pursuit of his evil lust, just as David had heard, oh, this is the wife of Uriah. But he pressed on. There was a check in his own heart, a check in his own conscience. But he pressed on. And now he sees that same spirit of resistance to the check of God emerging in his own son. That spirit of defiance growing and multiplying in the activities of Amnon, his firstborn. He employed the services here. If you look again at Amnon's sin, you'll see that he employs the services of one of David's nephews to accomplish his evil designs. You have a reference there to Jonadab, Amnon's cousin, and the son of Shimeah, who was David's brother. Here is one of David's nephews aiding now in this wicked scheme to deceive David, to deceive and victimize poor Tamar. And Amnon relies on the evil genius of his nephew, or his cousin rather, one of David's nephews at this time. Just as David had employed the services of his own messengers to go to take Bathsheba, as he had employed the services of another nephew of his, Joab, in the dispatching of Uriah, in the deceiving and the murder of Uriah, David had used another one of these nephews, Joab, the son of his sister Zeruiah. And again, there is a parallel emerging here. David's sin exactly coming out again in the life of his son. Perhaps one of the cruelest deceptions that is recorded in Scripture is recorded in verse 6 and following, where Amnon, at Jonadab's counsel and advice, makes himself sick, sends for David, and he has David send for Tamar and send her to her ruin. How do you think David felt as he looked back on these events? Don't you think the heart, the father's heart, was absolutely shattered to think, I was the one who sent her there. I was the one who sent my own girl to her ruin, to her desolation. I was the one who sent her. But then, would he not remember another commission? I was the one who sent Uriah, not to be shamed, to be violated as Tamar was, but to be killed. I sent him. And now here's my own sin coming home to me in the lives of my children. And I find another order given.
and I have sent her to her ruin. Oh, sin comes back exactly as it was sown, it was reaped. That's true in Amnon's case. And if you think carefully about this, you will see these and other parallels with David's sin. He sowed and he reaped. Think of Absalom. Because Absalom's crime against his brother Amnon replicates features of David's sin against Uriah. Let me point out just a couple of them. In verse 28, Absalom was ready to use wine to pursue his criminal purpose. And he prepares this feast. He invites Amnon. He makes him drunk. And mark ye, he says to his servants, when his heart is merry with wine, then smite him and kill him. Did David not resort to such tactics with Uriah? You remember how chapter 11, verse 13 tells us that he made him drunk to send him home to try to escape the blame of his adultery. Trying to coerce Uriah to go home to be with Bathsheba for that time. He made him drunk. That sin comes back again. How many a father, how many Christian fathers have found that when they have used a little alcohol along the way, has come back to haunt them in the lives, the ruined lives of children destroyed by alcohol. David sowed that sin and it comes back in the life of Absalom. David had stained his hands with the blood of murder as he used the sword of the Ammonites through the plotting and the aid and the abetting of Joab in that conspiracy that they launched together. Uriah died. Absalom kills Amnon. No, not directly, not personally, but through his servants. Amnon is guilty of the murder of his brother Amnon. And David's sin comes back. We could take a moment to look at Tamar, because the ruin and the misery and suffering of Tamar is part of the harvest of David's sin. He who had violated the marriage bond between Bathsheba and Uriah in adultery now sees his own daughter violated by Amnon. Why does she suffer? Why does she see this ruin come upon her? Why? The answer is very simple. Because her brother followed in her father's footsteps. That's why. Tamar suffers not only the indignity, the shame, the misery, the desolation, the ruin that she does here at the hand of Amnon. She suffers it simply because her eldest brother followed the example of her father. Part of the harvest of David's sin. All of these things are the fruits of David's sin in a number of ways. We have particularly pointed out the fact that these sins in Amnon and Absalom's lives, the suffering of Tamar, is connected with his most recent sin with Bathsheba. That's particularly in view here. That's where there is the clear, strong connection between these events and those of chapter 11, where David fell into adultery with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah. But they are the fruits of sin in a more extensive fashion than that. Because they are the fruits of other sins that we can trace down through David's life. We could say that the events of chapter 13 here are also the fruits of David's failure to properly discharge the duties of a godly father. There is a harvest of that sin. It was his responsibility to bring his children up in the ways of God. It was his responsibility under God to see to it that his sons followed him in the paths of the Lord. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, in the verse 18, you have a statement there of the duty that God lays upon fathers particularly, a duty that most definitely applied in David's case and still applies to fathers today. Therefore, shall ye lay up these my words, verse 18, in your heart and in your soul, and bind them for a sign upon your hand, that they may be as frontlets between your eyes. Oh, if David had obeyed that word,
And if the law of God had guided David's eyes, he never would have fallen with Bathsheba. If the law of God had guided and restrained his hand, as is commanded here in this 18th verse, then he never would have put his hand to make Uriah drunk. He never would have put his hand to slay that poor man. It's the personal responsibility that God lays upon fathers. They are themselves to obey God. But he goes on, and ye shall teach them your children. Speaking of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, when thou risest up. Oh, if David had been in the habit of, even as he walked about his own house, speaking of the things of God, don't you think that when he walked upon the roof on that evening tide, things would have been different? Thou shalt write them upon the doorposts of thine house, upon thy gates, that your days may be multiplied, and the days of your children, in the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers to give them, as the days of heaven upon the earth. Did Amnon live out all his days in the land? No, he didn't. Did Absalom live out all his days in the land? No, he didn't. Did they live days of heaven upon the earth? No, they did not. For David's home has now come to be more like a hell on earth than a heaven on earth. It's an evidence of the failure of David as a father. 1 Kings chapter 1, the verse 6. You have a remarkable statement of how David conducted himself toward his sons. One son in particular is in view. His son Adonijah, younger than Absalom, but of the same spirit. Verse 6, his father had not displeased him at any time. His father had not caused him a moment's grief. He had never caused him any displeasure at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? And he also was a very goodly man. Again, there's physical beauty here. And his mother bare him after Absalom. And here is one of David's sons. And I think that we have reason to say that what we read here of Adonijah didn't just apply to him, it applied to all of David's sons. Especially those who turned out in the way that Absalom, Adonijah, and Amnon did. He had never displeased them. He had never once challenged their sin, like Eli before him, who had never rebuked his sons, saying to them, why have you done so? What is this that I have heard? He had never rebuked them. He had never displeased these boys of his. Rather, he had shown indulgence and tolerance toward their sin. And while the world today may smile upon that kind of parental activity, it's in defiance of God, it's contrary to God's law, and it reaps the harvest of wickedness that now comes forth in David's home. Amnon and Absalom and later Adonijah live as they did because David had not dealt with their sin. Here are lads who grow up living for the flesh, never having been brought under discipline, never having been taught that that is wrong, and restrained from sin and chastised for their sin. What does that kind of parental activity produce? Produces evil monsters. That's what it produces. The modern social engineer will tell us that if we discipline children according to the command of God, we will damage them, we will destroy them, we will produce those that are filled with hatred and with violence. It's the wrong way round. Violence in Amnon's heart was produced by a father who didn't discipline his sin. The murderous violence of Absalom's heart was produced because he never was rebuked or disciplined for his sin. There is a word of warning here, especially to Christian fathers, on the upbringing of children. David failed
to discipline, to check, to curb, to instruct his children away from sin and into the things of God. And here's what he produced. The harvest is being reaped.
Let me suggest to you something else, that this action in 2 Samuel 13, it is the harvest of prolonged indulgence of sin in his own marital life. Now this comes into focus in both of these sons, both in Amnon and Absalom's case. It causes us to reflect upon prolonged indulgence of sin as far as David's marital experience was concerned. Just think for a moment. Put yourself in Amnon's place. What was David's example to Amnon as far as how a man should conduct himself toward a woman? What was David's example? It was a lifelong example of selfishness and sin. We have referred before now to David's multiplication of wives. On a number of different occasions, David adds to his wives, repeatedly multiplying wives, taking women who pleased him into marriage and into concubinage. David had set for his son an example of unchecked, unbridled, indulged lust. There's no nice way to put it. Yes, he was a man of God. Yes, he was a child of God. But there's no pleasant way to describe the sin that David engaged in the multiplying of wives. And as far as Amnon was concerned, his father's example was one of you take what you want when you want it. That's what he saw. You read of David married to Michal. He goes then and he adds Abigail and Ahinoam. He comes to Hebron. You read there in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel of sons born to David in Hebron by 6 different women in addition to those that were already referred to. Then he comes to Jerusalem in chapter 5 and verse 13, and we're told that when he comes to Jerusalem, he takes yet more wives and concubines and has more children in Jerusalem. Michal, of course, had left him for a time. She is restored now to his household. There are all these wives. Now, most lately, he has added Bathsheba. What an example to set for Amnon. Can we wonder, naturally speaking, can we wonder that Amnon acted as he did? What example had his father set him? Oh, the consequences of sin are reaped in children. But then think of Absalom. Absalom brings us to consider another aspect of David's household. If you go back to chapter 3 in the verse 3, we read that Absalom was his third son, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. That's why he fled to Geshur. That's where the king of Geshur was his maternal grandfather. But think of this, David married a heathen. Now, in taking Maacah to be his wife, he not only disobeys the commands of God that relate to the multiplying of wives, but he also disobeys the specific command of God about taking a wife who was a heathen and a pagan. But David took Maacah. If we can read anything into the record, especially the details that are given to us about Absalom's physical appearance, we will conclude that Maacah must have been a very beautiful woman, because both Tamar was fair and Absalom was also very handsome, we're told. That comes out later in his rebellion against David. There was none like him in all the land for beauty. Well, if we can tell anything, then it may well be that David married Maacah, took her into his household simply because of her physical attraction. He married a pagan in direct disobedience of God. And Absalom was the product. And Absalom lived as a heathen. Absalom demonstrates the heart of a pagan. The consequences of David's sin are reaped in his son. There are solemn lessons for us to learn here. How we conduct our homes. How we conduct our marriages. How we discipline our children. All of these things. How fathers conduct themselves in the home, in public. The awful consequences of sin, reaped in the sin and suffering of our children. But let me close with this point. And if it's possible for the story to get sadder, it gets sadder at this point. Because even as David begins to reap the harvest of sin,
there's further sin on his part. Even as he begins to enter into the harvest of past sin, we find him sinning again.
You know, very often sin brings us into circumstances where it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to do the right thing. In our sinning, we forge chains and put them on our hands. And we bring ourselves into circumstances where, even though we may know what is right and we may know what we ought to do, we are faced almost with the impossibility of doing what is right. That sin has made such a mess of our lives that I can't do what is right, it seems. One sin inevitably leads on to another, and soon we find ourselves in a spider's web of sin, and we're as helpless as the fly in the web to do what's right, to get it back into the way of serving the Lord as we desire. Many a child of God has been brought by their sin to the place where they have to live with the reality, I can't do what I want to do. I can't do now what I would love to do for God. I can't do now what maybe in other circumstances I would be eminently qualified to do. Because I have sinned. It's interesting that in the circumstances that David now faces, you have a blatant rape carried out in his own household. You have a murder carried out in his own family. David, the chief magistrate in the land, the upholder of the law of God, what's he going to do? What's he going to do now? It has to be significant that there's no record of him praying. There's no record of David getting before God, even though he lies on the earth here in sorrow and heartache and misery at a later point, yet for years David had not done what was right in Amnon's case. You see that? 2 full years pass by and David has countenanced Amnon's sin and never done anything about it. What makes his failure even worse here is that when he heard it, he was very wroth. Verse 21. He was angry. He knew it was wrong. He knew it was evil. It grieved him. It vexed him to his heart. But by being angry, David did not satisfy the demands of justice. Look at Leviticus chapter 20 and the verse 17. And here's just a simple statement of at least one of the regulations of the law of God that applies in this circumstance. If a man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, and see her nakedness, and she see his nakedness, it is a wicked thing. And they shall be cut off in the sight of their people. He hath uncovered his sister's nakedness. He shall bear his iniquity. Now there you have a consensual act. In 2 Samuel 13, obviously it is not. But there are principles that will apply. God pronounces the death sentence on such activity. That's what God said should be done. David got angry. It's not quite the same thing, is it? David did not do what was right in Amnon's case. He got angry, he knew it was wrong, he knew it was sin, he was grieved by it, but he still didn't do what was right. David didn't do what was right in Absalom's case either. Numbers 35 and the verse 10 indicates that Absalom too faced the death sentence. He was a murderer. He ought to have been put to death. It's what divine justice demanded. But over a period of 3 years, all the while Absalom was in Geshur, according to verse 38, he was there for 3 years. Over that 3-year period, David, the judge, the representative of God and his law in the land, gradually came to the point where he entirely overlooked Absalom's sin. It was as if it had never happened. And he wanted Absalom home. That wasn't right. That wasn't justice. That was more sin on David's part. Now there were family, national, social implications to David's failure here. When David didn't do what was right in Amnon's case, David sowed more seed. He sowed the seed of murder. Because I believe it was because David didn't do right in judging Amnon that Absalom then took the law into his own hand and murdered his brother. The end result was the same. If David had done what was right, he would have executed Amnon. Amnon would have been dead. But Absalom would not have committed murder had David done what was right. What David is doing here is sowing the seeds of total breakdown of law and divine order, not only in his own household, but also in the land. He had countenanced these crimes in his own family. What did that say to the ordinary Israelite? What did that do for the standard of morality and justice in the nation? What did that do for good order in the society of the day? Here is the king, and he's not doing what is right. He's showing favoritism to these criminals in his own family. You could see how quite naturally that would lead to the breakdown of good order in the land. I have no doubt it had an effect upon the morality of the nation, and I believe paved the way for the men of Israel and Judah to follow Absalom in his rebellion at a later time. Good order, what was right, began to collapse in the land because David, as the divinely appointed administrator of justice, did not do what was right. Now, I have no doubt it was difficult. It would have been difficult for him to do what was right in these circumstances, but he should have done what was right. We're left looking at a situation here that teaches us a number of significant lessons. It teaches us that those who have the God-given place of exercising disciplinary authority, whether it's in the home or society or in the church, those who have that responsibility to exercise disciplinary authority are to live so as to avoid sin. As far as it's possible, to live a blameless life, because here's the reality. Sin compromises the calling and the duty that God has given. David compromised his ability to administer justice in the land because of his own sin. His sin with Bathsheba, his sin against Uriah, compromised David's ability to administer law. How could he, if we reason naturally, how could he administer justice to Amnon or to Absalom, since he himself had been guilty of the same crime? He seriously compromised his ability to exercise discipline and to carry out that magisterial responsibility that God had given to him. Now that's true on those other levels of disciplinary authority that God has instituted. It's true in our homes, as far as the office of the husband is concerned, as far as the office of the father is concerned. These are positions of responsibility that God has given. Those offices are compromised as the holders of those offices sin. The more wicked, the more blatant the sin, the more seriously and irreparably compromised the office is become. The more serious the sin, the more likely it is that we get to the point where our hands are completely tied. And even though we know what is right and want to do what is right, if God has restored, for instance, a father who has fallen deep into the sins and wickedness of the world, but God has restored him, he sees his children following in his path, to some degree his hands are tied. Tied because of his own sin. He has compromised his ability to exercise that God-given responsibility and office as far as his children are concerned. He loses credibility by his own sin. A husband will lose credibility with his wife, whom God has commanded according to the biblical order to be in subjection to the headship of her husband. But the wife, and who could blame her, loses respect for, the husband loses credibility and any real ability to exercise leadership and government in the home as he falls into sin. In the church, it is for this very reason that you find those words given by the apostle that dictate the characteristic, the important, vital characteristics in the elder, in the deacon. living a blameless life, knowing how to rule his own household, ruling his children with gravity and in fear. Why? Because how can he rule in the house of God if he can't rule in his own home? Can't be done. So you see, David's ability here to govern, to rule, to guide, to do what is right, to discharge that vital aspect of his heavenly calling, it's compromised. I believe I'm right in saying it's compromised in David now almost irrecoverably because of his sin. Let us remember these things as we occupy those positions of authority, as a parent or in the church or in some other way. Let us remember that in the duty that God has given to us, we can only do that as we keep ourselves pure and keep ourselves from sin. And then the other thing is this. I believe that even where there has been a compromising of that authority, there still is a duty to do what is right. There still is a duty to do what is right. Let's take the case in point. The father had sinned. He had been restored by the grace of God. While it would have been immensely difficult, and with anguish of heart and agony of soul, it would have been so difficult to do what is right, yet the command of God is the command of God. And David had a duty to obey. It may well have brought ridicule. It may well have brought harsh words. But he had a duty to do what was right. And sadly he failed. Even as he reaps the harvest of one sowing, he's sowing again. Sowing seeds to be reaped with more misery and more sin later in his life. Oh, that God would impress upon your heart and upon mine tonight the awfulness of sin. The need to be so careful. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that, exactly that, God will see to it that that is what he reaps. May the Lord help us to fear sin. To fear our own sin that will be transmitted by example to our children. Something personally speaking that has often exercised my own heart. I've prayed along these lines. Lord, knowing the pollution of my own heart, I don't want to sow that in my children. I don't want to see them grow up demonstrating my sin. The only way to avoid that is to be in constant battle with my sin. Constantly dealing with it. Constantly putting it away. Because as sure as there is a God in heaven, if I indulge my sin, then it is in the lives of our children is exactly where we will see that sin reaped and produced. Let's bow together in prayer.